are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, March 19th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Nathan J. Robinson, editor-in-chief of Current Affairs, on Jordan Peterson, the intellectual we deserve. Also on the program today, Jeff Sessions fires FBI Deputy Director McCabe as Mueller attacks grow from the Trump administration. Meanwhile, another bombing in Austin, Texas, the fourth this month. Trump supposedly makes White House staffers sign NDAs. And surprise.
What a shock.
Facebook does not protect your data. New report. Class secondary to race and fate of black men in this country. And on the eve of the 15-year anniversary of the start of the Iraq War, the question remains, is Iran next? Lastly, Toys R Us, vultured to death by Mitt Romney et al. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. I suspect you already sense that I am under the weather today. I will do my best to persevere through the entire show. It's quite possible I may just get through the interview. It's quite possible I may pass out during the interview. We shall see. I wanted to create that. They always say, you know, when you're doing a, when you want to create some suspense, is you leave a loaded gun. That's what you write that in the first like 10 pages of the script. Put a loaded gun, maybe put it in the you put it in the drawer of the desk, the bureau. And that's what we have here. I just loaded the gun and I just put it, I said the gun is loaded and I've just put it in the bureau.
This is sort of like when Michael Jordan had the flu in the playoffs.
Sort of. Sort of, just sort of like that. Folks, I haven't taken a trip in a long time. I haven't. It's been a long time.
May I suggest Dubai?
Yeah. Well, there you go. Part of the reason why I don't travel, or at least in the past, is that all the planning. Like, how are you going to find a place to stay? It's just stressful to plan it and to book it. But there's a solution for this. You don't have to go to like 20 different sites to figure this out now. Tripping.com, one search, lets you compare every home from the world's top vacation rental sites in one place to find the best deal on your perfect vacation rental. Because nobody goes and stays at hotels anymore. Why would you do that? If you're going to go for like a couple of days, stay in somebody's house and be fully stocked. You can decide whether or not you go out to eat, cook there. I don't know. You go to the beach. Vacation rentals offer more. They offer you more privacy, more space for everybody under one roof, more choices, fully stocked kitchens, extra bedrooms, even hot tubs. Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Yeah. All the comforts of home, and then some, like plus the hot tub. I don't have a hot tub in my home.
Hot tubs here.
I don't want to reveal too much, folks, but don't have a hot tub in my home.
Just at the studio. Can we end early today?
I've got a cold, so we're going to have to call it off for today. Best of all, at Tripping.com, you can join millions of travelers who find more savings with rates up to 80% less than traditional hotel rooms. So if you go on a spring break on the beach in Florida, Tripping.com. Want to swim in Lake Tahoe this summer? That actually sounds like something I definitely want to do. Yeah. Tripping.com. You've ever been to Lake Tahoe? It's gorgeous.
Oh, really? It is gorgeous.
Dreaming of sitting on the deck of a Smoky Mountains cabin? Tripping.com. This year, save time and money when you book the vacation home of your dreams with tripping.com/majority. That's tripping, tripping.com/majority. Find your perfect vacation rental at tripping.com/majority. Check it out, folks. And, you know, it's like everything else I say. The best time to check out a vacation site, like tripping.com/majority, is when you don't need one. Get the lay of the land. Go in. See, maybe you get ideas of where to go.
Maybe when you're bored at work, you want something to look forward to in life.
Maybe not so much at work. Maybe it's best not to do it at work.
Oh. I'm sorry, what was that? Lake Tahoe does look good, guys.
Hold on for a second, folks. There's some pretty big news that we get from Fox and Friends today. Casey Shimkus brought us some of this report. So this is pretty... buckle up, folks, because it's about to get bumpy. You're not going to believe what's happening on Twitter.
All right, some of the trends this morning. Another Hollywood elite once again taking aim at the White House. Jim Carrey, the comedian, painting that portrait of
Sarah. Pause it for one second. Now, what was the last thing that Jim Carrey... Is he still making... Is he doing anything?
I have no idea, but as I say, this portrait of Sarah Huckabee Sanders is his best work since In Living Color.
All right, so, I mean, he's a Hollywood elite. Taking on, I guess, the political elite,
it's
right?
Life,
I mean,
lifetime
he's in
title.
The White House. But good.
Sanders, as a monster, blasting her on Twitter as a so-called Christian whose only purpose in life is to lie for the wicked monstrous.
Well, here with the outrage lighting up social media as Fox News headlines 24/7 report.
Like, wait a second. So there's more to this story, folks. It's not just that Jim Carrey painted a picture of Sarah Sanders Huckabee or Sarah Huckabee Sanders and said that she does the work of a monster. There's more to the story, so we better bring in a correspondent, and here she is.
Media is Fox News headlines 24/7 reporter Carly Shimkus. Carly, this is the actor Jim Carrey.
This is the actor comedian Jim Carrey,
who also
does
guy?
Yeah, the Dumb and Dumber guy, who also does a lot of art on the side and has posted it to Twitter more and more frequently. He didn't mention Sarah Huckabee Sanders by name, but the general consensus is that is an unflattering drawing of her. About 9,000 comments have been written about this picture, and it's clear that the people who don't like the Hollywood folks talking about politics don't like this, and they're very ticked off about it. So I think we have some viewer comments on it.
All right.
Jamie on Twitter says, I wish you were still making movies so I could go not see them. Oh. Ian writes, to summarize, you're insulting a woman who worked for the world's most powerful office. You're mocking her appearance, and you're presuming to know more about her private faith, one held by millions of other Americans, simply by what you see on TV. But she's the monster. And then Amy writes, I will always stand by freedom of expression, but can we act our age and not call out people for their looks? And Tony simply says, Jim Ho. So some people say, you know, this is just downright bullying. Others are saying, hey, freedom of expression. He could
sure.
do whatever he wants.
Absolutely. But
there you go, folks. Now you know the whole story. Jim Tony Camato was like, Jim Ho.
I like those lines. I like the Jim Ho. And I mean, whatever, forget hypocrisy, blah, blah, blah. We always say that. But I do have to say there is something just particularly beautiful about Trump devotees being like, can we do better?
Right.
Criticizing people's looks.
Yeah. Also, like, for a TV station where every woman has to look like a fucking blonde Barbie doll to work there, I would say glass houses.
Oh, without a doubt.
I also like that that's literally her job. They're like, now here's the woman in the cocktail dress who reads idiots' tweets who watch
well,
the show.
But to be fair, she is 24/7. That's what she was brought on as the 24/7.
She was up all night.
So
doing
she was
that
up
story.
All night tracking the Jim Carrey story and pulling different reactions to the Jim Carrey story from like Tony and Amy. And
I love that humor structure too. That like, I wish she had a new movie so I could not see it.
Exactly. Well, it's
you don't
inversion.
You don't not suck.
That's comedy.
There you go, folks. Now you know the rest of the story because a lot of people were. Emailing, like, what's going on now with this whole Jim Carrey thing? And I just wanted to get it out there so that we wouldn't have this hanging over us over the course of the whole show. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to be talking to Nathan Robinson about Jordan Peterson and what is wrong with us
so much
that he is. And look, Well, I'll tell Nathan this when we return. We'll be right back. Sam Seder, Majority Report. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program the editor-in-chief of Current Affairs, Nathan J. Robinson, on his piece, The Intellectual We Deserve. Welcome to the program, Nathan.
Thanks, Sam. Nice to be with you.
So I went out to dinner the other night, and I think I've told folks this story here, but I went out to dinner the other night with friends of mine, and they brought their 15-year-old nephew, who was going through a breakup with his girlfriend. And at age 15, you get a little bit upset about these things. And he's a very smart guy. He follows a lot of politics. And he said to me, a friend of mine sent me a Jordan Peterson video to help me feel better about things. And he goes, what's with that guy? He seems like an idiot. And I was both horrified and gratified. Gratified that he could see that this guy was a little bit thin, but horrified that he's being sent around to 15-year-olds as a way of making them feel better about their lives. So the timing of this piece couldn't have been better. Let's, for folks who don't know who Jordan Peterson is, tell us, just give us the thumbnail on him.
Well, he's a University of Toronto psychology professor in his mid-50s, and for the past sort of several decades, he's kind of been just an obscure academic. And in the last couple of years, he has developed first a huge cult following and then a kind of far more mainstream following. Initially, he had come out as a very strong opponent of Canada's efforts to add gender expression and identity to the Canadian Human Rights Act, and Peterson had suggested that if this was passed, he, as a professor, could be prosecuted for refusing to use students' preferred gender pronouns, and declared that he wouldn't ever use student preferred gender pronouns, well, unless under certain circumstances, he kind of qualified it. And then it became a kind of free speech hero to certain people, and he has a YouTube channel where he records videos to his followers, and he kind of developed a huge following among young men in particular. About 90% of his viewers are men, and he got a lot of money on Patreon, you know, tens of thousands of dollars a month, I think nearly approaching $100,000. And then he released a self-help book, 12 Rules for Life, which quickly shot to the top of Amazon and is, I think, still the number one most read book on Amazon at the moment.
Wow. Just getting back to that first, I guess, inciting breakthrough event, Was the I'm not familiar with that that Canadian provision that would have added gender identity to their Bill of Rights, but would that have criminalized Jordan Peterson's use of the improper pronoun?
There's no evidence that it would have. I mean, the provision actually is quite vague, and you know, Peterson was suggesting that it's because it's vague, it could be used to prosecute him, right? It literally just prohibits discrimination against people because of gender identity. And it was Peterson's interpretation that this could be used to prosecute him for refusing to use pronouns. But that's not in the bill. The bill literally just prohibits discrimination on gender identity.
So, all right, now let's go over a little bit of his work, because I mean, you introduced me to far more of it than I think I probably feel comfortable.
I'm so sorry.
Yes, apology accepted. But it's important because really, the real question at the end of this is like, what is driving this stuff or the appetite for this stuff? But before we get there, we should, you know, sort of. And frankly, around these parts, we go through this with a little bit with Sam Harris, who you mentioned briefly in here. But there's a quality to Peterson that I think is shared by some online, and that is when you basically talk about that it's sort of hard to understand, to know what he's saying. More often than not. Give us a couple of examples of that.
Well. But first, I think it's just important to understand that the self-help component of this is really, really important. So people might have been surprised, given what he became known for, which is, you know, refusing to use pronouns, that he would release a book called 12 Rules for Life. But actually, for his followers, that's a hugely important part of what he does. The reason that your 15-year-old friend was being given Jordan Peterson's videos is because he structures this a lot around life advice. And his whole pitch is his academic work is in, he's a Jungian, and he's giving Jungian interpretations of mythology and sort of showing the commonalities among human stories across time and coming up with all of the sort of lasting archetypes. But then he uses this and sort of translates this into a set of advice for, especially for young men to get their lives in order. He's known for saying, you know, clean your room and clean up your act and put your life together. So that's a really important part of it. But when you get down to what he's actually saying, this is tough because it's tough to understand. And if people look at the article, I've given tons of examples of Petersonian prose, which is almost uninterpretable. You know, I have long passages. One passage is, procedural knowledge generated in the course of heroic behavior is not organized or integrated within the group and the individual as a consequence of simple accumulation. Procedure A appropriated situation 1 and procedure B appropriated situation 2 may clash in situation 3. Under certain circumstances, intrapsychic or intrapersonal conflict emerges and moral reevaluation becomes necessary where behavioral options are rank ordered and this organization is in its concrete, abstract, intrapsychic, and interpersonal variance occurs as a consequence of, quote, war. The Maps of Meaning is 600 pages, and it's full of this stuff. And, you know, getting to the bottom of what he's saying is really difficult, and that's part of it. That's a huge part of it, because what it means is that people can project their own interpretations onto it, and that means he can appear more insightful than he actually is, because you are working to struggle to figure some meaning, and then when you discover it, you feel like he must be really smart and that you must be really smart for having discovered it.
Right, and the meaning that you've discovered is really more of like a reflection of yourself than it is what he's saying. I mean, as far as I read that passage there, he's saying there's such a thing as cognitive dissonance, and when you have two competing values in yourself, you have to resolve it.
Yeah, right? So when this is one of the most important things here, is it's not that there isn't meaning to the passages. There are things that he says that are perfectly true. It's just that they're kind of really obvious, and they're not original intellectual contributions. And the way I liken it to someone who takes all of your possessions and buries them and then gives you a set of instructions for where to find them, and then you find them and you're really thankful to the person, or someone who, like, kidnaps someone you love and then you're thankful to get it. You're like, no, this was mine to begin with, right? I knew this already. And what Peterson does is to make it seem as if he's presenting you with something original that actually we all know.
Yeah, I like this where he says, in the purely intrapsychic sphere, such conflict often emerges when attainment of what is desired presently necessarily interferes with attainment of what is desired or avoidance of what is feared in the future. In other words, sometimes your short-term and long-term goals conflict.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Which is true. Right?
Yes, it's absolutely
it's not
true.
Wrong.
Yes. I think, like, most people probably, you know, this is something that you understand, like, as you get out of your teenage years. Like, you know, when you start to realize, mm-hmm. like, you know, maybe I like to party, but I also might want to, you know, establish a career or something. Oh, I guess I'm not going to be able to go out and drink all night tonight, so I get up and go to work tomorrow. I mean, that's basically what we're talking about here.
And, but if you phrase it that way, nobody would praise you as a brilliant intellectual. They would just be going, oh, that's a guy who seems relatively sensible. But if you buried that within a lot of convoluted language, people would actually think you were a sage.
Now, let me ask you this. Like, does he put, you're putting these things in italics, because he uses italics, you say, a lot. To make it sound like the way that he's using a word is very different from the way the sort of the pedestrian usage of the word. I mean, just explain that tactic.
So that's a common thing in academic writing. I'm just looking through the Massive Meaning book right now, and I see a mandrake root has the nature of a man because it has the shape of a man, shape being italicized, or things that both cause fear, and then he explains the attribution of femininity, attribution is italicized, that serve to undergird the idea of lawful authority. And every time it's put in italics, because if you put something in italics, and I've done this before in my writing, because it's very effective, actually, because if you put something in italics that's actually very simple, people think, well, they must mean something. That must be very meaningful because they put it in italics. So it's just a small thing. That's just a tiny thing, but it's a thing that you can notice throughout his writing. And actually, it's something to be on guard for a lot, is people trying to be insightful. As I say, I've used it by emphasizing particular things.
Okay, so and as we go through this, you also give examples of, like, where he says something that is then he immediately is upset that it's misinterpreted, I guess, right? Like, this would be the I'm trying to go through here and see where's a good example of that. Is the Toronto woman who calls him a Nazi, let's say, or All right, go.
Well, there are a few examples of this, right? One is that the big one is chaos and order, right? One of his entire frameworks is chaos and order, and the world is divided into the chaotic and the ordered. His book is called An Antidote to Chaos, and in it he says, you know, chaos is associated with the feminine. Order is the masculine, and order is the structure of society. It's the things that, it's the glue that holds everything together. Order is that social structure. And you think from that, well, you know, order is really good. And he's saying that, you know, women are just chaos and we have to have an antidote to femininity, right? If chaos is femininity and he's offering an antidote, that suggests that he's, like, against femininity. Then, of course, he contradicts that. He comes and goes, no, I'm saying that it's like yin and yang. You've got to have order and chaos at the same time, which makes the whole thing kind of meaningless, because then you go, well, what are you really saying then? If we're not trying to stop chaos, we're just trying to incorporate it, it all becomes kind of a soup. So usually either if the thing he's saying that seems specific seems horrifying or wrong, and then the qualified version that seems so abstract and convoluted as to not have any practical import. And you mentioned the Toronto Nazi thing. Peterson says in one passage, he said, he says something about physical, the physicality undergirding everyday interaction. He says basically everyday interactions are built on a foundation of looming violence, and interactions between men always have a looming threat of violence. And he said, for example, there is a woman in Toronto, and he talked about how you can't use violence on women. He said, there's a woman in Toronto who compares him to a Nazi, and he says, I can't use the tactics, the techniques on her that I would use against a man because they're forbidden, i.e. physicality, physical violence. So that seems like he's saying, well, I wish I could hit this woman, but there's a social taboo against it. But then if you say, are you saying you wish you could hit a woman? He would go, no, of course not. I'm just saying that the looming threat of physicality is essential to the whatever. And so you try and pin him down on things that sound horrifying, and he denies them. And what it means is that there's an ability for people to interpret his words to justify really horrifying things. You see people endorsing domestic violence in the comments of his videos a lot. And that interpretation is reasonable because he's so vague.
I mean, this is, you know, there's a dynamic here, and I want to broaden this out in just a moment, but there's a dynamic here that we, you know, you could see almost with Donald Trump, right? Like, he goes out and articulates certain ideas that then give license to people to take it further. And that's sort of the dynamic that's happening, why guys like this are so dangerous in some fashion, right? Because they are opening the door to certain ideas. And of course, this isn't about debate, but they are also simultaneously not owning those ideas and giving people, giving basically another concentric circle out there the license to go out and practice these ideas.
Yeah. So you're totally right. And I think, so someone emailed me who likes Peterson and said it was very unfair of me to, and unethical even, to judge Peterson by his fans, to say, well, you have to judge him. You can't do what the fans are saying. But there's something, but the Trump comparison is exactly right. It's like if I had fans and my fans were all wearing swastikas, I would be very alarmed. And I would be wondering what I was doing that was not, at least, maybe not endorsing, but at least not repelling that type of person. Right? And the same thing with Trump and the white supremacists, where he was giving all these messages where they loved him. You know, David Duke loved Donald Trump. You know, Richard Spencer, very excited about Donald Trump. And, you know, that's not because Trump was, you know, saying explicitly racist things. It was because he was saying things, the sort of things that racists like to hear. And then you could go, okay, well, it's not his fault they like to hear him. But then all of his statements on it were very sort of qualified, and I go, well, you know, who knows who's my fan? I don't know who's my fan. But it's like, we are responsible for the consequences of what we say to a certain degree, and for the predictable consequences of what we say. So, you know, for example, in current affairs, sometimes, like, people on the alt-right have picked up our articles, like Mike Cernovich or someone, have liked the things that we've said. And when that happens, I try very hard to say, no. This is not what we're saying. We are not this. This is not a fair interpretation of what we're saying. It's really, really important that you make sure that you are not fueling something horrifying. So I think we do have a certain responsibility for that. I think that's one of the things with Peterson, where, you know, he's not saying anything that's explicitly white supremacist. He's just saying a lot of things, again, that white supremacists really kind of like.
Right. And it's, I mean, this is the idea of being a public intellectual, right? Is that you do take responsibility for how you're interpreted on some level. I mean, obviously you shouldn't mold what you do based upon, you know, narrow sets of people's interpreting. Some people are always going to misinterpret. But
right.
And here's, I want to just move in, and before we sort of like broaden this out even more, the when he's talking about, and this I just found fascinating, when he was interviewed by this Channel 4 interviewer, Newman, and you say that largely that interview may not have been that fair because she put words in his mouth or something, but there was one or two exchanges they had, particularly around the idea of him comparing left wing, I guess, social justice warriors to Mao. But there was another part where he said, which I thought was really fascinating, where he wrote, like, liberalism got flipped so that the world was turned into one group against another. Power struggle from one group against another. And then the social justice warrior types and lefties, even the Democratic Party, started categorizing everybody according to their ethnic or sexual or racial identity and made that canonical element of their being. And the only thing I could think was, where was this guy for the other 200 years of the American project? Right? Like, the idea of categorizing people as, let's say, black or, you know, Chinese or minorities or women and giving them a set of rules was the founding of this country. Right. Like, you're black.
Right.
You're a slave. You're a woman. You're a property of your husband. You don't get to vote. Like for someone to say that seems that they have a huge blinders on some level.
Right. Yeah, thinking that, like, feminism is what decided that women were different from, women had different interests from men. So two points. First, what you said, this interview with Channel 4, it's funny because all of his fans, and he got a lot more fans after this interview because people saw it as an example of someone in the press treating him very unfairly. Because all through the interview, the interviewer is saying, so you're saying X? And X will be something like, you know, so you're saying women just can't compete with men? And he'll go, no, that's not what I'm saying. And they go, look, see how unfair the interview is? But actually, all interviewers of Jordan Peterson end up saying, so you're saying X? Because Jordan Peterson is really unclear all the time. Right? You kind of have to put words in his mouth because you're trying to figure out what words are coming out of his mouth. And, you know, so when he says, you know, the social justice ideology was responsible for is the ideology that was responsible for the Soviet Union, you go, wait, are you saying that it's the same? And then he goes, no, I'm not saying that it's the same. And then they go, so what are you saying? So I think it's not necessarily that unfair to him to try and do the so you're saying thing. But as you say, there is this, you know, substantively, there's this total lack of knowledge of history. He doesn't even understand what activism is, right? So in this other interview, he says, basically, activism, he says this thing started in the 60s where you would go out and hold paper on sticks and shake it at people and it to signal your virtue. And you go, that was the civil rights movement. Like these guys, holding, I don't know what they're doing, standing there holding signs. That seems ridiculous. You go, it was the anti-war and the civil rights movement. That's what that was. It's so strange that he can't even understand, like, what the roots of activism were. He can't even see it from the point of view of the activist. He doesn't even really seem to understand what politics are. Like, he talks about, like, getting rid of ideology and the importance of examining yourself rather than getting involved in politics. And people have said to him, well, if you don't like the social justice movement, you know, what do you think political activism should consist of? And his answer is basically like, well, you should clean up your room and examine your own life and your goals, right? He just fundamentally doesn't comprehend why women and black people and other people of color might be upset, like what they're frustrated about the arrangement of contemporary society.
I would also add that the protests, the idea of putting a stick in paper did not start in the 60s. There have been protests in this country since, well, the Tea Party, right? I mean, the idea that there haven't been protests, I mean, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, it's sort of extraordinary because what he's really talking about is like, and he's not talking about age because those women in 19, whatever it was, 19 were in their teens. He's talking about like hippies and black people, it seems like.
Yeah. So it's just a lack of understanding of the context. He thinks that like Again, and this is common to criticisms of identity politics, which and it really frustrates me, is this failure to understand why people think that identity is somewhat important. You know, if you examine the Black Lives Matter, for example, has put out a very serious policy agenda where they talk about the police reforms they'd like to see, they talk about what the things they'd like to see done to address the black-white income gap and the wealth gap, and employment discrimination. These are the sort of serious issues that people in social justice movements are discussing, and they do disproportionately affect people by race. And so people like Peterson, who are critics of social justice, just go, well, why do you keep talking about race? And they explain in detail why they keep talking about race, why we can't pretend that race doesn't matter. But Peterson doesn't really respond to those arguments or even show any sign of comprehending them. And this is very common among the people like Ben Shapiro and the people like Charles Murray, who all say, well, this identity thing, it's racism of its own. And they're like, well, at least pay attention, at least try and understand, like, what people are saying about, like, the unique issues that face women and people of color.
All right, well, so let's talk about what it says about us or American society. Like, why, and there seems to be, I mean, a series of these people what is it that is... What's wrong with us that that this guy who is not really saying much, and to the extent that he is just sort of like giving license to some pretty noxious tendencies, has become so successful, and more important than his just sort of like marketing success? You go through in the first couple of paragraphs of how he has, like, there is, you know, folks like Malcolm Gladwell saying he's a wonderful psychologist. I don't know how Malcolm Gladwell could possibly know that. I mean, unless he's been treated by him. The Times saying his message is overwhelmingly vital, deserves to be taken seriously. Why is he getting these type of accolades? You know, I understand why he's getting YouTube hits, because YouTube is predominantly male, and there's a lot of young males on YouTube. But why is he getting these other accolades?
Well, okay, so yeah, the YouTube thing, that is puzzling in and of itself, or at least worth discussing in and of itself, right? His extraordinary following among this group of young men. I mean, the cynical interpretation is, well, you know, young men like it when you come along and flatter their worldview and say, like, you're the Ubermensch and feminists are trying to drag you down and, you know, stoke people's prejudices. Peterson says, and I think he is somewhat correct about this, that he appeals to people who are lost and adrift and lack sort of purpose and guidance in life. Even the jacket of his book pitches him as a father figure. And so I do have a sort of a partial explanation for his following that says, well, he is sort of a product of a time when a lot of young people especially are very adrift. It's an economy that isn't working for them. It's a place of political and cultural meaninglessness, and there is a big market for someone to come along and go, look, I'm going to help you, I'm going to fix your life, I'm going to give you a sense of purpose, you're going to be a hero. So I do think that there are economic and social explanations in part for why he's attracted such a following. I actually think it's less of a mystery why the press would praise him, because I'm pretty cynical about the mainstream press, and I think any time someone comes along who looks like an intellectual and has a following, I mean, look at the way that the New York Times has covered like these white supremacist doofuses, you know, where they all get like long form profiles.
Right.
So there is a sense that whenever there's a social phenomenon, the press feels like, as part of its objectivity mandate, it has to take it very seriously and it can't just write it off. And so Peterson, the people have declared Peterson an intellectual, therefore he must be an intellectual. And the press sort of doesn't want to appear elitist. and tries to reflect public opinion in a lot of ways, and this is kind of a result of that. I don't know why Malcolm Gladwell. All I can say is I don't. It diminishes my respect for Malcolm Gladwell's ability to tell truth from nonsense. But I think that a lot of these guys come along every generation and get hailed as the next whoever, who don't actually have much substance to them, because of the separation of academia from popular intellectualism, where, you know, academics aren't engaging with Jordan Peterson.
Right.
Academics couldn't care less about Jordan Peterson. They know that he's not substantive. But academic journals are a separate world from the popular press. And so this is also why you see a lot of bad science journalism, is because science journalists aren't scientists. There's a big separation between these worlds, which I think is bad.
Is this a new phenomenon? I mean, I've spoken just casually, socially, to professors of religion and professors of and to neuroscientists, actually, and like actual neuroscientists. And I bring up, let's say, the name of Sam Harris, and they're just like, "Who? What? I've never heard of this person." Yet, maybe it's, you know, the circles that I am exposing myself to, or, you know, like, is there? But there really does seem to be this huge chasm where I feel like any of these neuroscientists, like, they work at Columbia, they do experiments on people's brains, could just say, like, what? No, that's nonsense. I don't have time to engage in this, but what is on YouTube? You're like, a professor of religion would be like, what? He's talking about the Hadith?
Yeah.
What are you? What? No, of course not. And yet we don't. There's this chasm. Is this phenomenon new? Is it a function of social media in some way that you can create a huge following with a veneer of expertise because you're swimming in circles that you're not going to bump into an actual expert?
Yeah, I think so. It's funny. That's so funny because, you know, to many people, Sam Harris is the most famous neuroscientist in America.
Yes.
And, you know, so it's so funny that neuroscientists don't really take him seriously. But that's, yeah, I mean, it's hard to know what the actual explanation for, you know, I can conjure different theories as to why this is happening. You know, maybe it's because a lot of academic fields have gotten much more technical as they've gotten much more advanced. So the things that a neuroscientist is focused on today are that many more levels removed from things that ordinary people are ever going to be able to understand. I do place some of the blame for this on academics themselves, because there is a kind of sense among many academics that engaging with the public is something that is at best optional and at worst actually almost anti-intellectual, which is weird, right? I was in a graduate program in sociology, and I'm still in it, actually, but there's a kind of contempt in academic departments a lot of times for people who write, quote, popular books instead of academic books, and people who publish with popular presses rather than academic presses, which is very strange because you think, well, popular should be a good thing. Getting your message out is really important. And I think academics need to see it as much more of having a responsibility of trying to guide the public's understanding of their field, because otherwise the people who are charlatans, or at least are very superficial, they will be the public spokespeople for a field. And you know, so it's super important that if you do know about something, you take control. And it's depressing to me that, I mean, I've written long pieces about, like, Charles Murray and Jordan Peterson, and I wish, I'm not an expert in their field, and I wish that people who were already doing that, so I wouldn't have to.
Yeah, it's strange. I mean, and I wonder if it's also a function of, like, there's no reward in academia for doing this. And that the competition could be such that, like, I'm not going to expend energy on something that is tangential to my academic project. I mean, I wonder if that's how much that is involved. So what,
that's a huge part. because it's all of the incentives are towards publishing in academic journals, which is basically the only thing that you're supposed to do as an academic to get accolades, right? It's just publish. They don't even value teaching. Your teaching is not something you're supposed to focus on. Writing op-eds in newspapers, it's all a distraction. You need to publish academic articles.
Does this put the left in a disadvantage long term? Because I mean, I think, you know, statistically speaking, maybe short of economics, academics tend to be center left because just of the nature of the project, I guess. A long term, are we going to be at disadvantage? Like, I mean, now that there is an ability to become, you know, in the ease in which someone like a Jordan Peterson or a Sam Harris or even like, you know, Stefan Molyneux had this going on for a while, you know, a little bit more cultish perhaps. There's these outlets for folks like this who are ostensibly thoughtful to reach the masses and make a tremendous amount of money and without really being debunked. I don't know. Is the left at a disadvantage in this sense?
Well, the left is always at a disadvantage, right? Because the left is speaking for the people who don't have power, right? So we're always going to be fighting uphill. We are. And of course, it's gotten worse with the kind of cable newsification of knowledge, and this is the thing that climate scientists complain about, is that when you have a crossfire-type discourse on television, if you look at the difference between, say, William Buckley's Firing Line in the 60s and Fox News in 2018, it's a huge difference because it's, you know, 2 minutes versus an hour, and in 2 minutes you can't really expose someone as a fraud. It takes depth, right? My article's 11,000 words. As things get compressed, it's much more difficult to challenge these things, and as attention spans get shorter. At the same time, we have a formidable opportunity with the expansion of things like YouTube and podcasting and what have you, because it does allow you to do things that are in more depth, right? In current affairs, you know, I was able to start a magazine that does in-depth analysis, and we've built up a decent following, and that's very possible. And podcasts are the same way. You can go for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, and you can really dive into things. So I don't think it's impossible to take these guys on, but I think it's a formidable challenge, and one that I think everyone who has knowledge has a duty to help spread knowledge and challenge people who are presenting things that aren't knowledge as knowledge.
Nathan J. Robinson, Current Affairs on The Intellectual We Deserve. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break here, head into the fun half, wherein I will peek out at 101.7 degrees in my fever. And we've got, what do we got? We got this Cambridge Analytica whistleblower on Channel 4. We've got Hannity on Fox and Friends. That's like one of those crossover episodes where your favorite characters from both shows show up at the same place. Now we've got like a whole show full of these guys. Ben Shapiro, Peter Thiel. Folks, this program relies on your support. You can be supportive of this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. And when you become a member, we say thank you. And we say thank you by giving you extra content every day. jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Check out TMBS. It is on tomorrow night on our YouTube channel. You can just subscribe to it right away on iTunes. You can do that right now. That way, it'll automatically come to your phone or your computer device.
And just for MR people, Matt Binder is going to be in tomorrow. So
Matt
a little
Binder.
Reunion, a little reunion of sorts.
Matt Binder, public shaming. Matt was very helpful for me. I don't know if I mentioned this, but I recounted the story as I was talking. There are people writing about Mike Cernovich and
Mike Cernovich, Cernovich.com.
It's coming up, but Matt Binder was one of the first people I contacted when I heard from MSNBC that they were concerned about my tweet. And I was like, hey, dude, do you know how to, like, find other tweets that I had said at that time? It was 9 years before, and I wasn't sure. So he came back with a couple of tweets that showed the context in which I was suggesting that if my daughter was going to be raped, that it be by a older and very accomplished film director.
He sat back and he mainlined a Monster Energy drink.
Yep.
Got to work. We're going to do a Matt versus Matt contest, actually.
Oh, really?
Yes. Old Matt versus new Matt.
Jamie's Patreon, available at patreon.com/JamiePeck.
Yeah, I also wanted to make the point that everything is free. I know it's located at Patreon, but you only have to give me money if you want to.
Whoa, there you go, folks.
You can just read my writing. That's more than enough for me.
Free riders, welcome. So check it out today. All right, going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. We will take your phone calls and your IMs.